thank you so much for being available. We just feel such a kinship to you and Helen and your work. And we just feel like we've gotten to know you, and we have a wonderful friend in Nashville, Rod Kotitsky, who introduced us to Imago Therapy years ago when he joined our board. He was one of our original board members. So it's just been a wonderful journey to learn more about Imago, and we're hoping to introduce a lot of people to Imago through our book. So a lot of people probably don't know that you and Helen wrote this wonderful parenting book.
You know, I think it's not been a great seller relative to the other books.
Well, you're so known for your relationship work, they might not have been looking for it. So we're hoping that'll introduce a whole new audience of young parents to
Giving
the Love That Heals, because we just feel like it is a tremendous guide for parents. So I guess my first question would be about this book, that what influenced you and Helen as parents to be more sensitive to your children? Was it your professional experience, or were there other outside influences such as books you read or support groups that confirmed that what you were feeling as parents, you know, led you to develop this wonderful book, Giving the Love That Heals?
So the question is, what led us to pay attention to our children, or is the question to writing of the book?
Do you think that your experience as therapists were the major influence, or were there other influences, books that you read or other things that confirmed, I guess, what you were learning as therapists to develop your parenting strategies?
Yeah. Well, I think that, let me respond to that question with what prompted us to write the book.
Okay.
And I think there were two things, and one was that we are parents and have six children, and so consequently, and they are they comprise a blended family with two that we brought each, so there were four to our marriage when we married, and then we created two, so we have the range right now of ages 23 to 40.
Wow.
So we had nearly every age of a child somehow in our home at one time, dealing with the newborn on the one hand, and sort of acting out adolescent on the other hand.
Wow.
So we were very interested in how to blend a family, and also how to help children in the way that we were concerned about helping couples. And the second influence was that we were very actively engaged at the time that this book, Giving the Love That Heals, became as a possibility in our minds. We were involved in couples workshops, and couples would inevitably, as they still do, come up to the front of the room to visit with us once they got the idea that their childhood and their relation with their parents had impacted their choice of a partner. And as we try to say with as much force as we can, not only the choice of your partner, but the way you will relate to that partner and the quality of that relationship is determined, or certainly deeply influenced, if not determined, by the types of parents you had and the quality of your relationship with those parents and the quality of their relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you live with anybody, when a child lives with parents, the power of that relationship and the necessity of that relationship for the child makes the relationship internalized as a model. So there's all kinds of complexity about what happens. And so as people would ask us these questions, they would also, and they would come up and ask the question, does this mean that what we are doing in our relationship is impacting our children? And, of course, given the fact that they were coming to a workshop, indicated, obviously, that they were having difficulty in their relationship, or they would be out fishing that afternoon instead of, you know, at a workshop about their marriage.
Mm-hmm.
which meant that their marriage had some strains in it, and mild to severe difficulty. So they were wondering, well, is this affecting our children? And we always answered the question candidly as possible with, of course, it's affecting your children, and your children are going to model, their internal model of a family will be your relationship with each other, as well as your relationship to them. And so they were pretty shocked about that, and they said, well, do you have a book on parenting, on how to translate all this into parenting? And this time we didn't. But that was the stimulus for beginning to think about, well, we need to figure out how to be a parent with all these children. And there's this request, essentially a request from couples coming to couples workshops, that we write something about children. So that's sort of an answer, hopefully, to sort of two-pronged question about how it all came about.
Well, I guess the other part of that question, when I asked, were there other influences, because it seems like you and Helen were influenced, you know, somewhat by some of the same people my husband and I were. Our youngest child is 23, and to hear you, to see in the book that you're so beautifully talking about the importance of that early attachment and how important it is to have, you know, a loving, nurturing, responsive relationship, to hold your baby with in a sling, for instance.
Yeah.
That was very progressive back for the mid-90s when you were writing that. A lot of people didn't know what a sling was.
Right.
And, and to, when you sleep, you know, have your baby in close proximity so you can be responsive.
Yes.
I mean, there's just so many similarities to what we would call attachment parenting, so
right.
the things you're recommending.
Right.
So that was very affirming to us, knowing you were coming from a more therapeutic background and recommending the things that we were hearing about maybe through La Leche League or through a breastfeeding organization or through the books of Dr. Sears, a pediatrician, who was recommending these kind of things. So to hear it from other disciplines was really one of the reasons we wanted to start attachment parenting, so we could say to parents, you see that there's all this cross, these cross disciplines are recommending the same kind of nurturing responsiveness.
Yes, right. And in fact, it was, I think it was during the, it's interesting that the same time that, I think we could say parenting began to shift from a practice of socialization to a practice of nurturing, was at the same time that marriage therapy began to shift from a practice of conflict resolution to mutual healing. Mm. That there's a shift in the culture and in a number of places. Developmental psychology was one of the places it began, and of course. I'm blocking the name of the attachment theorist right now. John Bowlby was the head of most of these people, but that he had already established the concept of attachment, and all this, and he and his students and colleagues had begun to differentiate the various attachment styles. Was a little bit ahead of or simultaneous with the emergence in the field of a real focus on the concept of care, of nurturing, of somehow of, and the, I think the other word that was coming up in those decades was the word attunement, which is a whole new word that, in fact, I remember as I was working on these contributions from the science of psychology, developmental psychologists, as well as Bowlby, and that the and I Sears, I'm familiar with him. I probably, it's been a long time ago, but he wasn't like an interior person like Bowlby was, or Mary Ainsworth, or Mary Main.
He's a pediatrician.
But the concept of the concept of attunement was evolved there and began to modify the definition of nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting shift from socialization, where you're supposed to basically do what the Bible said, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. Teach your child how to behave, teach them, and you, there's a term, concepts of discipline and concepts of regulation. Was very different from nurturing, and then attunement was very different from nurturing, because nurturing was, you know, you should take care of the child, respond to the child's cry, be sure to keep the child warm, keep them full, and keep them near you, and so forth. But what wasn't being said that began to be said was also tune in to who they are and to what what's happening for them, rather than applying a parenting style and applying parenting disciplines. Parent the child from the child's experience of its own needs, and that you have to learn how to listen to the cry, or the pre-verbal cries, and then later on there will be verbal protests. And so instead of telling children what they need or trying to figure out what they need or give them what you think a child needs, you have to really figure out, what does the child need?
Mm-hmm.
And help the child language that in some way, so that to be attuned is very different from just being nurturing. And I remember an example that made that so clear for me was that a child was in a park, and a big dog ran over toward the child to, you know, as big dogs do, run over and to lick the child, to see the child. The child had never seen a big dog before, and so just panicked. And the mother ran to the child and picked the child up and said, you know, there, don't cry, it's okay, this dog is not dangerous, won't hurt you. Hey, good, see doggy, good doggy, don't cry. And, you know, the child stifled its tears back and was still looking terrified. Whereas, and so that was a good nurturing mother, but an attuned caretaker would have said, oh, you're scared. Wow, that dog was so scared. That dog is so big. And gosh, I bet you thought this doggy might hurt you. And so the child, that you're then attuned with the child, whether the child is has language or not, you're joining the child's experience of panic with some intensity and some responsiveness to that. And then what will happen is the child's emotions will, they will diminish. They'll go away, and the child will integrate this experience because it's been afraid and got attuned with and also held. And then you can say, hey, let's go over and look at this dog. Mm-hmm. And then talk to the child about you know, engaging the dog, maybe touching the dog, and you touching the dog, and the child sees, well, this dog is not dangerous. But when the child is in the panic of the dog as, you know, dangerous, to say the dog is not dangerous doesn't allow the child to integrate the child's experience that the dog is dangerous.
Exactly.
If you hold the child through that experience, then they will themselves integrate that and also then shift to the reality that the dog didn't bite them when you went over. So attunement is plugging into the panic, and nurturing is trying to quiet the panic. And I thought when I read that example, that's amazing, you know, and that's what we're exactly trying to do in dialogue with couples. Is if your partner is upset, you don't say, what are you upset about? And don't be upset. You say, well, tell me about what you're upset about. Let me listen to that.
Mm-hmm.
You listen, and you're empathic with it, then the upset will go away because it's replaced by the relationship.
Wow.
So those are a major parallels between how to parent a child and how to relate to your partner.
Excellent example. Well, it reminds me, too, of the early arguments between the attachment theorists and the temperament theorists. You know, this is such a blending of that, the principle of attunement.
Yes.
Yes, you know, it's all about attachment and being sensitive to your child's temperament.
Yes.
It's not a neither nor. It's like the old argument of nature and nurture.
Yes.
We now know it is both.
It's a both, yeah.
A
Right. And we know that whatever nurturing you do will either amplify and ground nature's trying to do its thing. The child's trying to is living in the world out of its own neurophysiology, and you can live with that and support that, or your parenting could go totally against it. Like some children are more active and more sensitive, and others are have less energy and are more thoughtful and reflective. And if you say to the sort of held back child, the child holding back his feelings, not doing it because they're scared, is doing it because that's the tendency. You can really mess that up by saying, hey, you have to show more energy. And so that the child then has to split off from itself, its own experience of itself as being quiet, but ought to be noisy or active. Mm-hmm. And that produces a split in the child between its experience of the context and the experience of itself. And I think that's probably the biggest human tragedy that we parents foist upon our children, is that we invite them to shut down their connection to their authentic selves.
Yes, and how that will impact them in their lifelong relationships.
It will impact them in their lifelong relationships, in their own a sense of cohesion and wholeness, their own sense of happiness. I know I read in the past 2 years, I've been noticing that happiness books are being written now in droves. Part of it fueled by the rise of positive psychology, in which they are legitimately, and I think with great profundity, looking at what supports well-being, and that they also equate somehow that with happiness. But there are a lot of other books that are, you know, exploring happiness. Is it related to health? Is it related to wealth? Is it related to relationships? And saying, you know, that it's an elusive property. My view is that happiness is related to wholeness, and that happiness is a natural human state when peoples have not had to shut down and disassociate from aspects of themselves that were not approved and affirmed by parents in childhood. And so it's when you have to split off and disidentify with, and in some cases even reject as bad, a part of yourself, which is still there. You can't get rid of it. You can just, you know, put it in a box and not pay attention to it. That part of the self is always going to try to show up in some way. And you'll always be, quote, in conflict with yourself, because there's a part of you in a box and a part of you outside the box. And those two pieces are always going to be at odds with each other, sort of in the same sense that that Freud talked about the instincts of more than 100 years ago. That there's the impulses in the body that he calls sexuality and aggression, and then there's the superego, which is saying, hey, you can't express those, or you can only do it in a certain way. But we've known, whatever the theories were and the models, we've known that conflict is the source of a great internal misery. We've known that for a long time, and we began to know it scientifically in Freud, and now the developmentalists helped us do that. But the attachment people in Bowlby and have helped us understand the concept of the split, of the split self, in such a way that I think we have in that concept the source of human happiness, and that if you can reintegrate the split, have it owned and reintegrated, that then you will experience a quality of well-being that you would refer to as happiness, and it will in fact not be dependent on anything in your context.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little off the subject of parenting, but it's certainly on the subject of what the consequences of the split self in childhood is.
And it definitely, I would think, contributes to our high divorce rate, that we constantly keep thinking, well, this person will bring us happiness, or this, we just keep moving on to different, either material things or relationships, looking outside ourselves
right.
for that source of happiness.
Absolutely. And I think that the high incidences of divorce is related to that for also a second reason, that the part of the self that's split off and rejected is usually also projected onto your partner. Mm-hmm. And so your partner is a carrier of a part of yourself that you don't like. And so then, since you don't know that's going on, you assume your partner is that part of yourself you don't like, although you don't know that you have that part of yourself, and it's unconscious, and you begin then to criticize in your partner what was criticized in you when you were little. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you know, if you criticize it long enough, as we all know, your partner will actually become the person you're criticizing. If you say you're always angry, they'll eventually get angry. If you say, well, you know, you're never there and I can't rely on you, they'll stop showing up. Mm-hmm. And then when your projection and the partner's behavior match, then you're clearly it's your partner, and that leads to an enormous amount of conflict with the partner, so that you're then not in conflict with that part of yourself. You've got it all externalized with the partner, and it becomes then a relationship problem, instead of a part of your own self. But I also think that the split self is responsible for the high levels of drug addiction in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
When you split off a part of yourself, you experience emotional pain and a high level of anxiety because you've split off a part of yourself because it has been dubbed as bad, and now you have a part of you that's bad, and that could get you into trouble, and this raises your anxiety. And anxiety is the most painful thing anybody can have. The anticipation that something bad is going to happen is really intolerable, and one of the ways to comfort yourself, one of the ways to manage and regulate anxiety, in addition to projecting that split part of yourself off onto your partner, is to medicate yourself with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So that the conflict is actually transcended by drug, at least if you keep on taking it long enough. So it's one of the great human tragedies. I think the place where it also shows up is on the an intergroup scale, in that the intergroup can be anything from somebody in your family or a racial situation or a different gender, or can be, as we now I can imagine, can be at the national and international scale, that somebody's going to carry the rejected bad parts of yourself. You're not going to be conscious that it's really inside you. Somebody's going to be a carrier of that, and then that's going to attract your projections, and that's going to attract then your assaulting them or defending yourself from them. And it's, you can't get out of it because it's not really them, it's you making it them. And that this is the basis for international conflict and war and all kinds of human maladies that we could cure simply by the nursery, by changing the way we parent children, helping children keep their authentic selves so that they don't have to deal with the split, because I think the split is not built into us. I think the conflict Freud thought was built into us between the instincts and the superego are really a function of our interaction with non-attuned environments when we were little.
Yeah, well, you know, we used to have a slogan for our organization that we've since changed, but it was peaceful parenting for a peaceful world.
Oh, wow, great.
And we were really wanting to plant that seed that, you know, when there's peace in the home, then that will, like you're describing, you know, have a global consequence.
Uh-huh.
And I think that what we've seen in, you know, working with parents is that often a parent will, this consciousness will start to bubble up in them when they have their own child. And for the first time, they've had this consciousness of, wow, you know, what I say to my child is definitely what my parent used to say to me. I thought I would never repeat that behavior, and here I am doing it. You know, am I trapped? You know, or am I doomed to just be an unconscious person, or are there ways to raise my consciousness? And that's what we love so much about your book, Giving the Love That Heals. It's all about that consciousness raising and being starting out with that strong bond that will lead to developing this trust relationship with your child and that attunement that you're so beautifully describing.
Right.
Let me just read you a quote from the book that kind of goes along with what you're saying. We can kind of move in this direction. It was on page 6. It is appropriate for a partner to grow by meeting the needs of the other partner, but it is not appropriate for a parent to try to heal by having the child meet his needs. The process for parents and children is not mutual. The parent must heal his childhood wounds in an adult relationship and not in his relationship with his child. Would you comment on that?
Well, I think that ought to be the 11th commandment. For one thing, it's not possible to grow by getting your child to meet your needs as a parent, because your child cannot mm-hmm. meet your needs as a parent. They starting off as infants and pre-verbal and early, can't respond the way that you needed to be responded to when you were little. So it can't happen. Secondly, to ask a child to do that usually is to ask a child to therefore engage in that sort of helplessness. They may do something that they think is responding to your needs, but it's not there. And it also annihilates the child, because you're relating to the child as an object, as a resource for your needs or gratification in any particular way. So as soon as some person is seen as a resource, then the person becomes an object. And when any time you objectify someone, making them into an object, you at the same time emotionally annihilate them, because that you turn them into something else, and then you're relating to them if they were somehow congruent with the image you have of them in your own mind. In other words, you're relating the fantasy and overlaying the fantasy on the child. So I think it's not only not possible, but it's also immoral. It ought to be illegal. if we knew how to find those of us who have done that, that what's really important, and I think the insight that Helen and I worked with somewhat in the book, is that when you do have you experience your own emotions being aroused in your relationship to your child, or you experience yourself expressing feelings that are charged over and over again, behaviors that are repetitive, and also tinged with emotion, and you're constantly responding to your child in the same way and with the same emotion, what you know is that your relation to your child is now activating an unresolved relationship you had with your parents. Mm-hmm. And that the grace of this child is that the child is bringing you that part of yourself that you didn't integrate when you were little, or a wound that you did not heal, or a defense that you've not relaxed. And so so that you can really learn. But that's about as far as you can go with regard to the value of the child to your own psyche.
Giving you that insight, like a red flag.
Right, it's a red flag. It's happening over and over again. And then what you do is you take this issue to your caretaker, because more than likely that issue has shown up in your relationship with your caretaker, in which you have tried to relate to your, take it to your partner, in which that issue has shown up because you probably had that part stimulated in the relationship. So you take it to your relationship and you become each other's parent or surrogate parent to the, to use the phrases of the little boy or the little girl inside you. You take it to your partner and they become a surrogate parent to that part of you, or you become a surrogate parent to the little boy or girl inside of them. And the relationship of the marriage, the committed partnership, becomes a resource for healing. But what you'll also learn that you can do and relate to the child through is that the need that this child has activated in you that didn't get met in childhood is a need that you're probably not meeting in your child. That is, they're not the neural networks for responding to a child in the way that you were not responded to when you had that need as a child, and all children have basically very similar needs tempered by their temperament, mitigated somewhat by their temperament, but fundamental needs, which is to be present, fundamentally, is to be emotionally present and physically present, reliably and with warmth. And if you can get that down, and also to establish boundaries so the child doesn't hurt itself, that's sort of the universal need. So if you then see that that this has been activated, you can then begin to give the child, when the child asks for it, what you didn't get as a child when you asked for it. Then the child can become additionally a source of healing for you, because you can grow into being for the little child inside of you or the child inside of your partner what the child outside of you actually needs. But we don't tend to do that. We tend to go the other way when we get into reactivity with the child and relate to them in ways that are negative for the child's experience of itself. I think that the phrase, I like that, I've always liked that phrase, that what the child needs in order to be healthy and whole is for you to know, is for you to experience, insofar as you can, through empathic responding, attunement, the child's experience of the child's self. And for the child to know that you are experiencing its experience of itself is called being present to the child. And it is that emotional presence and physical presence that that regulates the child's anxiety. And therefore the child will grow up healthy and happy. And it's the degree to which you're present is the degree to which your child will benefit from being in your life. And the degree to which you're absent is the degree to which you will be a wounding resource for the child. And that those are always correlated in the sense of being present to yourself as well as being present to your partner. In other words, to me, I think what's evolved for Helen and me is we've tried to, in our older years, trying to synthesize and get down sort of like your, how many points do you have? 8 points?
8 principles,
Eight principles. I think we're kind of trying to get it down to one, which is presence.
Yes. Well, that's ironic that you're saying this, because October is Attachment Parenting Month, and our theme is to give your child presence. And the kind of presence you're talking about. So we're trying to shift this paradigm away from our consumer-driven culture.
Oh, that's wonderful. Give your child presence?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Presence.
P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E rather than P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S.
Exactly.
Yes. That present will really, that kind of presence is the most powerful form of grace that can be given to a child. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, so let me ask you maybe to give me a real short example of what you were just talking about. Say you have a mother who is, you know, has a very high need baby that cries a lot and seems inconsolable, and some mothers just kind of, you know, don't take it personally. They understand, well, I'm trying this, I'm trying that, and, you know, babies cry, and, you know, it's wearing, but they get resources. You know, they bring grandma in to rock the baby for a while, or get dad to, you know, give them a break.
Yeah.
And, you know, they just, you know, they'll call, if they're healthy enough to call, you know, a support group and get help, that's great. But you're talking about this is a red flag that possibly her needs weren't being, you know, addressed as a child, as a baby.
Right.
And that this is something that she could possibly talk to her partner about.
Right.
You know, that I really need some help here. I see that I'm just not able to respond to this baby in a healthy way. What would be a type of a dialogue that she could have with her husband or her partner about this?
Well, I think the way to make this most effective is that you have a dialogue, that that you ask for time to talk about that and say, you know, do you have some time? I'm having a real problem with our child. I have strong emotions. Do you have some time? And I need to talk about it. And would you just sit and listen to me and mirror back what I'm saying? And also, I'm not needing you to solve the problem, and I'm not needing you to give me any advice. In fact, trying to solve the problem and give me advice is what I need least right now. I really need to be able to talk, and to talk without being interrupted or without about any kind of judgment. Would you do that? And a good husband who's been somehow informed that this is a good thing to do would say, sure. So you would just simply sit and talk about what goes on when the child cries. That, and more than likely what's going to go on is that the first thing that's going to happen, you may not start by saying this, but initially, because you'd have to have a pretty high level sometimes of awareness or language to do it, but most parents would probably start off by saying, when the child cries, I just go into a rage, and I just go into wanting to choke the child. I want to go into, or leaving, just getting out of the house, and I want to, you know, and I'm afraid I'm going to hurt the child sometimes. And so what they're saying is that when the child cries, I get anxious. I really get anxious, and maybe Owen would say something like, not only do I get anxious, but I also feel powerless. I feel overwhelmed by this child's cry, by this child's needs. And so the parent mirrors it back and says, well, let me see if I'm getting that. When our child, little Mary, cries and cries a lot, as she's been doing recently, you just feel like you've got to get away from it and got to stop her from crying, either by getting out of the house or by hurting her or getting her to stop in some way. And you feel overwhelmed and by all that. Is that it? So is there more about that? And so you let the person keep on talking. And in a situation where they've been instructed how to have this conversation, the husband or wife, it could be either way, might say, so what does it bring up for you about your own childhood? And so they might say, well, you know, nothing. Had a perfect childhood. But with a little bit of education, you can say to anybody who's having these automatic emotional experiences, you had a difficult part of your childhood was difficult. That's why this is happening in your adult life. So, but anyway, the wife might say, well, I can't remember anything right now, so we'll, you know, take some time and think about it and see what comes up. Let yourself feel that the helplessness or feel the panic for a minute. And she would say, well, I'm remembering now, remembering that, you know, I just, when I was little, all I can remember, about 4 or 5 years old, because it's really hard to get any memories earlier than that without a lot of therapy, about 4 or 5 years old, I was just aware that I just couldn't get my parents' attention, and I cried a lot, and I just cried and cried and cried and cried and cried, and nobody would ever come. They just left me alone to cry, and you know, that's probably reflecting those were the days when if a baby cries, you let them cry. Mm-hmm. And after a while, they'll stop. Yeah, they will stop. But in the meanwhile, they will stop out of exhaustion and traumatization rather than because, you know, they got enough crying. Mm-hmm. So the memories can be brought in. And then the dialogue should be, well, so when you're feeling this, what do you need? What do you need for yourself? And then she could talk or he could talk about what they need. Well, I need, and I just can't tolerate this sense of helplessness, and I need, and I don't know what to do. I have no thoughts about what to do. So I need you to come in when that happens and either take over, take the baby, get a resource, or come up with some sort of way to relieve her anxiety about her helplessness. But if there's something repetitive going on, more than likely this will evoke a childhood memory. And then to integrate that memory into your mind as this is part of me I didn't know about before, then we'll regulate the anxiety a bit in the future. So that's sort of the dialogue, would be just to let the person talk and reminisce and associate and experience whatever comes up about talking about that experience. The main thing that happens here is what happens with good parenting, is that the partner who will be curious about this repetitive reaction and intense reaction and will be present while their partner talks about it and will hold them emotionally and physically, if they want to be held, will be for the partner what their partner's parents were not for them. And that's the grounding experience that a parent needs with their partner parent, so that they can eventually become a grounding experience with their child.
So an imago therapist would help to facilitate this dialogue and help the couple learn how to really be there for each other, like you're saying, emotionally and physically.
Yes.
And if, you know, if they're not able to go to an imago therapist, maybe they're a young couple with limited funds, they could read your books and learn about this intentional dialogue to begin this process, this conversation, and this nurturing of each other.
Yeah.
So that they can nurture their children.
Yeah, I think that's what I would say, is if you have access to a resource, a therapeutic resource, by all means use it, because this is like a two for one, that whatever you resolve here around the child resolves it for you and resolves it for your child. And it's a prevention for your child, and it's healing for you. So it's probably worth whatever it costs. And if not, if there is no resource, then you have to use what you've got. And so the book has some guidance about how to do that and what's going on to be sure and use that. The limitation I've experienced, however, is that some couples, and therefore parents, are so wounded in childhood that they cannot actually use information on their own. That they really do need resources. There's a whole another.
It's a red flag for that.
Yeah, this is a red flag for that.
So a red flag.
What is the red flag?
Yeah.
The red flag for that is that you just keep engaging in the drama over and over again, mm-hmm. and no matter what anybody tells you that you could try, you don't internalize the information by trying or by being curious about talking about it. It's just you're overwhelmed, you're flooded. When it happens again, you go through the same process, and when you're in it, you don't even know you're in it. You can't access any information. So you play out the drama again and again and again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And if you had a different childhood where you were somewhat wounded, like on a scale, say, of 1 to 10, you were wounded at, say, 6 or 7, with 10 being good and one being the more difficult wound, you were wounded somewhere around the mid, then you could remember what the book said, mm-hmm. or what somebody told you, or what maybe a good friend said, or your husband said. You could remember it. So when you had an emotional reaction, you could move from your limbic system, being now being stirred up by your amygdala, which is the part of your brain that senses danger. You could move from when you sense that, you could move up to your prefrontal cortex, and access the memory of the information. Oh, let's see. When this happens, I'm supposed to go talk to George. When this happens with the child crying, maybe they learn that one of the best things to do with the child is to pick up the child and hold it and try to get the child's, you know, attention. Don't force the child into it, but just, you know, be present for the child and hold it, relax, or whatever the information was. You can, like your computer, you can access it. But and that means you were not wounded in probably the first or second year of your life. You were wounded probably in the third or fourth year. But if you're wounded in the first or second year of your life, it's very, very difficult to learn from reading. You have to yourself have a new experience. And that's why I encourage certain couples who don't seem to be able to make any progress. They really have to put themselves in a context like therapy, or a workshop, or a workshop seminar where they work on stuff, so that they have a new experience. They have to have a new experience. They can't actually use new information. Mm-hmm. They have to have this new experience of being heard by their partner. And it's amazing that it doesn't take a lot of that to begin to help you regulate your anxiety and make you more accessible to information. But if you can't internalize information, you have to have a new experience, and usually you can't get that outside of some sort of social context. Sometimes it might be a discussion group with other mothers, where you just talk, and the other mothers don't criticize you, give you advice, just let you, you know, be present for you. Could be with your partner. Best place to be is in a professional context where somebody can guide that so that it's. Turns out to be safe and instructive.
Excellent advice. Let me just spell out imago therapy for anyone who might not know how it's spelled. It's capital I-M-A-G-O, imagotherapy.org is where a couple could go and learn more about their resources in their community and read about your programs and your books. We're just so excited about being a conduit, if you will, for families who come to our organization and want to learn more about healing their childhood wounds. Well, my last question is, how do you feel about modern couples? Do you feel optimistic about families in spite of all the modern stresses? Do you see a sensitivity in parents that will enable us to create a more peaceful, loving society?
Well, I actually do. I have been through cycles of optimism and pessimism. I tend to be an optimist, so I have to be more suspicious of my optimism mm-hmm. than of my pessimism, because when I feel pessimistic, I've probably got some data. But I think over the past 10 years, probably 10 years is a good number. I've become found my optimism sustained. That couplehood is undergoing a really radical shift itself. That the concept that marriage and other committed partnerships are resources for healing, and that the troubles in adult relationships are have their roots in unresolved issues in childhood, seems to be slowly seeping into the culture. The other thing that makes me optimistic is that we have in the past 25 years gotten information about children that we have not had for all the preceding centuries of humankind, about what children need in order to be healthy when they become adults. We have new information about that, and just like the crystallization of the concept of presence is a rather modern term. So we've got new information coming in about marriage, a new information about who children are and what they need, and therefore a science of parenting that goes beyond the tradition of passing on the limitations of the preceding generation to the next generation. We now have a science of parenting where we can actually teach people what to do, and it actually is effective for most situations. And I think that there's a growing awareness that the home is the resource for both peace or violence in the world. That's slowly seeping in. I know sometimes when I say something like that in public, people say it's ridiculous. We just have to learn how to, you know, how to manage the peace internationally. That people are bad, and that there will always be conflict, and probably always be wars. But I'm experiencing that there's a general kind of response now when I say, well, I think that the badness we attribute to people is simply people in pain doing bad things, or doing things we don't like, things that hurt us or hurt others. And people are not arguing with me as much as they used to about that, even the same sort of context. So I think that we are becoming more educated as a human species. I think we're becoming a little more enlightened by it, and I think we're becoming because of the process of globalization and the fact that boundaries in Europe were relaxed so that people can travel, that we're going to find that globalization is going to ultimately make us all, you know, planetary community, that there's a real urgency also showing up that we need to figure out how to relate, and that one of the ways to focus on that is to improve the quality of human beings on the planet, and that the only way we do that is by improving the quality of marriage and the quality of parenting. And I think that sort of it's not dominant yet, and you don't find it in newspapers, and we see a lot of other things contrary to that, but I think it's sort of an undercurrent, an under source of resource that's coming into our culture. And I'm looking forward, I won't live to see it, because I think it'll probably usually takes about 1,000 years to integrate a paradigm, but we also know that paradigms get integrated faster and faster. So if it took 300 years for us to figure out, after the rise of the democratic marriage, it took 300 years to figure out how to deal with the issues in that marriage, maybe it'll only take us 100 years to, because it seems like things take shorter and shorter periods of time. Maybe it's because of the increased information and communication. Maybe it'll only take 100 years to integrate this new information about how to rear children into our culture. But I think we will. And I just want to congratulate you and your organization and your energy and your book for, you know, being a part of that voice, because as you asked the question, and let's face it, you weren't out there some years ago. And that the material coming out of academe and the research labs is now beginning to show up as, you know, organizations, web pages, the dissemination of that is happening, because a lot of researchers don't educate the public. They just find the stuff, but there's some people like you and like me who, we find stuff, we tell people about it.
That's right.
And we want you to know about it. In fact, we want you to know you have to know about it because you're a part of the transformation of the world. So thank you for all the contribution that you're making by having this focus and by having an activity around it and a way people can get to resources.
Well,
so you're a part of my optimism about the future.
Well, wonderful. Well, I feel the same way, and as does Lisa Parker, the co-author and co-founder of API. We know we're all in this together, and the more critical mass of parents and professionals come together, I know this is really good news for our grandchildren. So we really have a lot to look forward to.
Yes,
well,
we
thank
do.
You again so much for your wisdom and expertise. And again, I know a lot of parents will be really appreciative of getting this issue of the journal.